it interests and pleases me very much to see that the few empty seats in the auditorium are all marked reserved. My tenure of this chair is almost at an end. After today's lecture, there is one more, and I will be delivering my final poetry lecture on May the 5th, Tuesday, May the 5th. In the third term, it is early in the term to avoid the exams. In the first and second terms, as you know, it comes right at the end. The title of the lecture is The Feel of Not to Feel It. The Feel of Not to Feel It. Once, as we were sitting by the falling sun, the thickening air, the chaplain came against the sky and quietly took a vacant chair. And under the tobacco smoke, freedom, he said, and good and duty, we stared as though a savage spoke. The scene took on a singular beauty, and we made no reply to that obscure, remote communication, but only stared at where the flat meadow dissolved in vegetation, and thought, O sick, insatiable, and constant lust, O death, our future. O revolution in the whole of human use of man and nature. The poem I've read is titled Spring 1942. Its author is Roy Fuller, father of the distinguished poet Auden Scholar and life fellow of Magdalen, John Fuller. It is intrinsically a fine poem. It is also pedagogically useful in enabling me to indicate numerous differences of pitch and tone between poems of the First War, the Great War, and of the Second, 1939-45. The basic facts about Fuller's poem are that it is in tetrameter verse, four beats to the line, in four-line stanzas, of which there are four, rhyming A-B-A-B, about as basic a structure as you can find in the long and complex history of poetry in English. The tetrameter stanzaic A-B-A-B poem, I would say, is the equivalent of the key of C major in music, seemingly uncomplicated, but requiring the hand of a master to reveal it in its true potential. Take the second stanza, freedom, he said, and good and duty. The three words capitalized and enclosed in quotation marks. And to add, if that is possible, banality to banality, the rhyme word for duty is, wait for it, beauty. Fuller is taking a huge risk here. Duty is a word that had been gathering dust in the lumber room of 19th, 20th century English poetry since Wordsworth's Ode to Duty at least. Stern daughter of the voice of God, O duty. First publication, I believe, 1805. Wordsworth's ode, as published then, belongs to the very same year that Nelson made his famous signal at Trafalgar. England expects that every man will do his duty. The value of the ABAB tetrameter to a poet who wishes to plug the virtues of freedom, good, and duty is that such a combination of meter and rhyme scarcely allows the author room to introduce any note of skepticism. Scarcely allows the poet room to introduce qualifications, supposing that he or she wishes to, and gives the reader equally little space for quizzing the concept, supposing he or she is up to it, before being hurried on to the next item, and in the case of this poem, a swift conclusion. But of course, this is the beauty and daring of Fuller's craftiness, his craftiness with denotation and connotation. He does wish to quiz the value of such transcendentals in the broad scheme of public values and the trickier ground of private thoughts, and most particularly in that shifting area where public and private values confront, affront each other, or uneasily combine. Once, as we were sitting by the falling sun, the thickening air, the chaplain came against the sky and quietly took a vacant chair. This reminiscent monologue recalls an occasion, real or imagined, it doesn't matter, around the middle of the Second World War, on a military Army Navy or Fleet Air Arm base, more particularly in a room where the men can relax, perhaps the Naffy Hut. The speaker indicates that, by and large, they are communing somewhat vacantly with their own thoughts. Once, as we were sitting by the falling sun, the thickening air, sitting by is related to standing by, which is related to being on standby. The air is thickening with ever-increasing tobacco smoke, pipe smoke, cigarette smoke, the kind that used to blast its way out in that same year, 1942, from the master staff room at Bromsgrove County High School, whenever the door to the corridor was opened and a gowned figure emerged. The chaplain came against the sky, that is to say, he first appeared as an upright silhouette against the light of the setting sun, uttering sibylline pronouncements, though in his tactical guise he is just one of the chaps. Since military chaplains were known as sky pilots, it says much for Fuller's sense and grasp of direction that his phrase doesn't become the metaphysical arena of chop logic that the term legal fiction becomes in Empson's poem of that title. Some of you here may recall that a previous lecture in this series was devoted to that poem. I do not denigrate Empson's poem, please note. I intend merely to indicate what I regard as a difference between Fuller's and Empson's approach to technique. Both are of intrinsic merit. Each is to be admired and learned from. And I do assure you that on the occasions when I have it in for a particular poet or poem, my voice shakes and rises in pitch, and my eyes become fixed and glazed. It's unmistakable. And under the tobacco smoke, freedom, he said, and good and duty, we stared as though a savage spoke. The scene took on a singular beauty. The poet Sidney Keyes, a younger contemporary of Fuller, once quoted an apposite remark which he attributed to W.B. Yeats, a remark which for the last 50 years at least I have taken up with acknowledgements naturally into my own critical language. I may well have quoted it in a previous lecture in this room. I'd be very surprised if I hadn't. Yeats, according to Keyes, though I confess that in all that time in trying to find its source in Yeats's writings, I have drawn a blank. Yeats demanded of an effective line of poetry that it should employ the intellectually surprising word that is also the correct word. The intellectually surprising word that is also the correct word. Roy Fuller, whom I've always regarded as being of the Auden school rather than of the Yeatsian singing school, nonetheless fulfills Yeats's desideratum in the third line of his second stanza. We stared as though a savage spoke. This is 1942, remember. The maps of the world on elementary schoolroom walls still show prominent areas of the globe colored pinkish red, and the celebration known as Empire Day still takes place in my elementary school classroom, at least. That cultic glorification of duty in late 18th and 19th century public life, from thence percolating into a variety of ethical, novelettish, and poetic idioms, regularly delivered to school anthologies by once powerful, now forgotten names such as Sir Henry Newbolt, as well as by Rudyard Kipling, who is a very fine poet and justly not forgotten. This delivery of made-to-measure imperial poetry was fueled by the imperial idea that duty chiefly consisted in going out to far-flung regions of the earth and there teaching indigenous savages, an elite may have qualified as noble savages, to submit to the benevolent aegis of the King Emperor. Fuller, I suggest, turns the imperial presumption very effectively upon itself. If Christianity was an adjunct of imperial superiority, nonetheless it is the mere agent of that secondary imperialism whose words fall as strangely on these young men's ears in 1942 as would the language of some quote savage unquote engaged in the utterances of his peculiar and unappealing creed. I worry slightly that my heavy-footed explication may have suggested to you that Fuller is writing a didactic poem and that I applaud him primarily for being politically correct. Not at all. The beauty of Roy Fuller's poem resides in the way that Fuller can turn and pitch his lines and phrases. What was it Yeats said again? Well, Sidney Keyes alleged that Yeats had said, the intellectually surprising word that is also the correct word. We stared as though a savage spoke. The scene took on a singular beauty, as though a savage spoke. I've tried to indicate the effectiveness of that semantic volte-face. The scene took on a singular beauty. This is, I suggest, the heart of the poem. I mean that tied in with the fact that it is line 8 of a 16-line poem. It is where Fuller gathers his meaning. And the pitch of the line is aesthetic before it is ethical, or let us say, the aesthetic subsumes the ethical. These young men in the Naffy Hut are depicted as apathetic or halfway between apathy and an incipient agnosticism. The scene took on a singular beauty, captures in 7 words that precise moment when Fuller discovers or rediscovers his vocation as a poet. In 1942, he was just 30. I use the present tense of the verb rather than the preterite because I am not alluding to an historical datum, but to an existential perception. He suddenly perceives how poetic form and structure may make clear and meaningful sense out of this rather shabby and amorphous encounter. Rightly perceived, one can restructure banality to become beauty, without, of course, denying the banality. And one of the ways to do this is by discovering the intellectually surprising word that is also the right word. And we made no reply to that obscure remote communication, but only stared at where the flat meadow dissolved in vegetation. Note that the obscure remote communication refers to three words of soul-numbing banality uttered by the chaplain: freedom, good, duty. It is pre-war spiritual commonplace that has been rendered obscure and remote by change of circumstance and place. One may suggest that we can see veins of post-war existentialism starting to emerge in young poets such as Roy Fuller in the early 40s. If there is anything in that suggestion at all, it is necessary to add that here it is indicated by lyrical suggestiveness rather than by philosophical or political discursiveness. The incipiency rests briefly but tellingly in a structural giftedness, something that T.S. Eliot once named, apropos Andrew Marvel, a tough reasonableness beneath the slight lyric grace, a tough reasonableness beneath the slight lyric grace. But only stared at where the flat meadow dissolved in vegetation. Flat, as Fuller uses it, is anything but that. It is simultaneously a topographical detail and a summation both of the feelings of the young, emotionally marooned men and of the chaplain's thinly spread clichés. The adjective in this context suggests simultaneously horizontally level, OED 1-1A, and unrelieved by conditions, OED 2-6A, and wanting in points of attraction and interest, lifeless, monotonous, insipid, especially of one's circumstances, surroundings, etc. E.g., how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seems to me all the uses of this world, Hamlet, Act 1, Scene 2. And thought, O sick, insatiable, and constant lust, O death, our future, O revolution in the whole of human use, of man and nature. In this, the final stanza, Fuller takes his greatest risk. The outcome could so easily have been disaster. In fact, it is a triumph in miniature. I refer to the thrice-used exclamatory O of traditional oratory, what the OED describes as a natural, or what now seems a natural, exclamation expressive of feeling. I think, however, we need to enlarge on that. I would have expected the OED to define the oratorical O as a natural or quasi-natural exclamation of feeling rendered artificial by its excessive use in poetry. The Oxford English Dictionary gives two instances from a 19th century poet, Tennyson: "Oh, for the touch of a vanished hand," and "Oh me, what profits it to put an idle case." But of course one can add innumerable others from that century. In John Barnard's edition of Keats, there are six occurrences of the oratorical O on pages 284 to 85, and I picked those at random. There are a further five on page 289. Again, I must insist that I am not intending to use these instances of the exhortatory vocative to denigrate that early ripe young genius from whom, after all, I have taken the title of this lecture. Nor am I saying that we should simply write off every oratorical vocative that we encounter in the long and varied catalogue of poems in English. I merely say that it is an effect to be taken note of. See, for instance, Earl, The Philology of the English Tongue, 1871. The O prefixed merely imparts to the title a vocative effect. The O prefixed merely imparts to the title a vocative effect. Earl's phrase "merely imparts" is the alerting signal. Merely here implies redundancy, that somehow the O can be redundant. Poetry in the 21st century perhaps needs to be especially on its guard against redundancy, since we are so accepting of the redundant and are already choking the oceans with our discarded plastic, and already inconveniencing the heavens with space junk. It really is incumbent upon poetry not to add to the amount of plastic and space junk. It is in some of his grandest phrases that Yeats employs the exhortatory oracular vocative. I choose to say grandest in preference to finest, because grand is contained in other words deriving from it, like grandiloquent and aggrandizement and grandiose, and therefore implies a degree of lurking contamination. The creative honesty of Yeats, I suggest, resides in his acknowledgement of this semantic fact and threat. The twin peaks of Yeats's poetry are generally agreed to be two collections, The Tower of 1928 and The Winding Stair and Other Poems of 1933. In The Tower, I recently counted 17 occasions of that usage, but please take my arithmetic under caution. I use the wetted index finger and not the calculator to arrive at these sums, so check me out on any numbers I give. Here is a characteristic tone of the collection, established by the last four lines of the final stanza of Among Schoolchildren. "O chestnut tree, great-rooted blossomer, are you the leaf, the blossom, or the bowl? O body swayed to music, O brightening glance, how can we know the dancer from the dance?" In the volume The Winding Stair, in which the latter book's Byzantium echoes and modifies the previous book's sailing to Byzantium, I have noted, again using the wetted index finger method, I have noted only three occasions, but I wouldn't go on oath that there are three, where Yeats uses the vocative oratorical O, and these are not in the major exhortatory works such as A Dialogue of Self and Soul, Cool Park and Ballylee, 1931, but in the two sequences or cycles of short lyrics, Words for Music perhaps, and A Woman Young and Old, that conclude the volume. Brief outbursts of reminiscent sexual pleasure and pain, as for instance, "O cruel death, give three things back," sang a bone upon the shore. Where Yeats is quite obviously tuning in to the archaic resonances of the ballad form while treating it very freely. Some Yeats scholar or critic must have pointed this out, this shift in pitch between The Tower, 1928, and The Winding Stair, 1933, and made something of it, though I can't say who or when, if. But of course you'll by now be asking among yourselves, why so much attention to this one detail when there is so much more to tell us about the nature of Yeats's poetry? I reply, because the life of a poem resides in the detail and not in the email. One possible reason for the manner in which Fuller employs the vocative in Spring 1942 may be traced to the exhortatory and recriminating poem Parnell's Funeral, included in Yeats's collection of 1935, A Full Moon in March. An age is the reversal of an age. When strangers murdered Emmett, Fitzgerald, Tone, we lived like men that watch a painted stage. What matter for the scene once gone? It had touched our lives. But popular rage, hysterical passio, dragged this quarry down. By we and our, Yeats means, in a sort of all-embracing sense, we 18th-century Irish with the ascendancy, and the strangers are the murderous justices and other political agents of the British Crown attempting to eradicate the indomitable Irishry, largely Catholic patriots with whom the Protestant Yeats felt spiritual kinship. See particularly Easter 1916. But the hysterico passio that destroys Parnell for an act of adultery is the much more recent bigoted and murderous sentimental quasi-religious violence of the mob, a substratum that Yeats, from his reading of Jonathan Swift, had come to hate, whipped up in Parnell's case by political opponents who wished him destroyed. Yeats's turbulent intellect recognizes that his own rhetoric, which includes, among many other technical details, the use of the oratorical vocative O, is on a pivotal balance between the masterly Augustan and post-Augustan rhetoric of Swift and Burke, where Yeats's constant reading and the tub-thumping invective of late 19th, early 20th century demagogues. I will risk here another dangerous. No, dangerous gives it too much vibes. Possibly dubious, that's it. I'll risk here a possibly dubious generalization by suggesting that a poet must have practiced many years, must have produced what is virtually a life's work if he or she is to carry out effectively the kind of high-pitched self-accusatory self-justification that Yeats performs in these late books. But I do urge caution in your acceptance of this suggestion, because a Rambo scholar, for example, could argue with some cogency that Arthur Rimbaud had completed the entire cycle of action-reaction before he finished with poetry entirely at the age of 19 or 20. Among the gifted British poets of the 1930s and 40s, some of whom did not survive the war, there was, of course, no one of Rimbaud's stature. And when Dylan Thomas referred to himself as the Rimbaud of Cwmdonkin Drive, he was retrospectively mocking his own adolescent ambitions and pretensions, albeit in a manner that contrived to indulge his admirers, among whom both then and now there were some who were in no doubt that the claim was entirely valid. Before I try you too far, in a wilderness of disjunct particulars, let me publicly remind myself what it is I am attempting to do and how I have proceeded so far. I have been attempting to make clear how good a poem Roy Fuller created in spring 1942. And in order to do this, I've had to delineate the twists, turns, and resonances of structure and diction. I've also had to attempt to hear how colloquial words and phrases interacted with formal styles of utterance during the period that Fuller and his younger contemporaries, Alan Lewis, Keith Douglas, Drummond Allison, Sidney Keyes, all four of whom, none of whom survived, we term, for critical convenience sake, British poets of the Second World War, at a time when they were writing things like this, the poems that I am considering in this lecture, to repeat, and thought, O sick, insatiable, and constant lust, O death, our future, O revolution in the whole of human use of man and nature, Roy Fuller. Oh, hear the wind that shakes the dawn, Sidney Keyes. Oh, have you seen the thorn that grows an angry red on briars when the frail wood rose is dead, Alan Lewis. But oh, the dragon dullness of myself, the turning seasons wither in my head, Alan Lewis. O sheriffs hung with long pearl-handled guns, showing your stars, coach-ditching dark road agents. O pony express on Sioux-surrounded plains, Drummond Allison. Oh, had she come? That year of submarines, she would have needed no sagacious kings, no hovering angels, no enlightened shepherds. She would have been her own effectual star. Drummond Allison. You who believe you have a kind creator are with your sire crowding into twilight, as using excellence, smooth instruments, material man makes himself immense. Oh, you may try, but can't deny his right, and what he does and destroys makes him greater. Keith Douglas. Oh, hell and fury then, my trust betrayed. What are these bones, 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 so disarrayed? Keith Douglas. Although I've not schemed to betray your trust in the past few moments, it is nonetheless the case that you have been radically disadvantaged by not having the printed text in your possession. Let me make it clear, therefore, that among the eight brief quotations just presented, Fuller, Keyes, Alan Lewis in one of his two citations, Drummond Allison in one of his two citations, Keith Douglas in one of his two citations, use the oratorical O. Whereas Lewis in his other citation, Allison in his other citation, Douglas in his other citation, use the demotic vocative O. O-H. I am leading up to the suggestion that the oratorical O brings with it a meteorite trail of suggestiveness regarding the correct way to address the capitalized abstractions such as freedom, good, duty. And the demotic O is for when you wish to say or imply, listen, I am not here imploring the muse or toadying to the gentle reader, but celebrating rather the democratic values embodied in my brothers and sisters in arms. In the case of the second Douglas quotation, oh, hell and fury then, my trust's betrayed. What are these bones, 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 so disarrayed? There can be little doubt that the thespian invocation is intended and ironically pitched, because the poem carries the title, A Speech for an Actor. Indeed, Douglas, who took part in the tank battles fought across the Libyan desert, and who was commanding a tank during the Normandy landings in which he was killed, writes as if he sees war as a version of Pollock's toy theatre, across which move somewhat stiffly the living, some uttering the requisite platitudes, and in which lie the stiff or ballooning figures of the dead, on whom platitudes may be bestowed by the unthinking, platitudes that are most certainly powerful forces to contend with, but which must be understood in terms of a fifth act peripeteia against which there can be no arguing. The decor is terrible tracery of iron. The eye and the mouth of each figure bear the cosmetic blood and hectic colors death has the only list of. Throughout his battle experience in North Africa, and albeit with tragic brevity in Normandy, Douglas was with the Sherwood Rangers Yeomanry, a Nottinghamshire cavalry regiment that, like other cavalry regiments, had switched to tanks. The regiment's second in command was Lieutenant Colonel J.D. Player, of the hugely wealthy Nottingham-based family that manufactured Players cigarettes. Now, a true blue English snob would have said that the Player family were arrivist tradespeople who had purchased gentry status with cash, rather like Sir Jesse Boot, yet another Nottingham tradesman who founded Boots the Chemist. But, living and dying, Colonel J.D. Player behaved with impeccable gentry style. After his death in April 1943, a newspaper report stated that he had left in his will £3,000 to the Beaufort Hunt. And in 1943, £3,000 was not to be sneezed at. And had directed also in his will that the incumbent of the living in his gift, to be translated as the Church of England rector or vicar whom Colonel Player had the manorial privilege of appointing to the local church, that the incumbent of his appointment should be a man who approves more work for the wetted index finger, I think. A man who approves of hunting, shooting, and all manly sports, which are the backbone of the nation. It is perhaps fair to say that the Lewis, Douglas, Alison Keyes generation had no doubt at all that they were putting their lives on the line for the preservation of democracy. No doubt whatsoever. For with Dachau and Vichy already known to be in the scales, no one could contend that Britain was not a democracy. But at the same time, they knew British democracy to be a grossly lopsided, botched job, as it still is, of course. And Keith Douglas and his mother, though living in near poverty, were by no means plebeian, as I and my school friends were certainly plebeian. And Sidney Keyes belonged to a wealthy family enriched by trade, like the Player family. Sidney Keyes' grandfather had patented Darren flour, once ubiquitous. A further irony is that Keith Douglas thoroughly approved of all manly sports, which are the backbone of the nation. In particular, he swam well and he rowed well. I recommend Desmond Graham's excellent biography, which was first published in 1974, on the off chance that you may wish to know more. Desmond Graham, Keith Douglas, 1920-1944, London, Oxford University Press, 1974, page 199. Ted Hughes admired Douglas greatly, as Douglas had admired Isaac Rosenberg greatly. Rosenberg, I only repeat what you were saying. And thought, oh, sick, insatiable, and constant lust, oh, death, our future, oh, revolution and the whole of human use of man and nature. Any poem that is seriously good is weird, and Fuller's poem is beautifully weird. It takes platitudes and makes them vivid. And like other lyrics that succeed, for example, the courtly lyrics of Sir Thomas Wyatt, language strangely mirrors itself, and any resulting distortion enhances rather than negates the effect. It has an Alice Through the Looking Glass quality or element in its deployment of common terms. When Arlen Lewis died in Burma in 1944 at the age of 29, he left behind one book of poems, Raiders' Dawn, 1942, A Book of Short Stories, The Last Inspection, 1943, and a further book of poems, Ha Ha Among the Trumpets, which was to be published posthumously in 1945. Editors of little magazines began to realize how intimately powerful were his letters to wife, family, and friends as records of army life and as testaments, his letters from India, to the imposition of alien codes, like those of the almost defunct British Raj on India's numerous indigenous peoples, hostile among themselves, ever increasingly resentful of British dominion. The magazine Wales published a posthumous sheaf of the English letters, 1941-43, and reading through them recently, I found this, written from Heysham, Lancashire, during his period of officer training. It looks as if he is billeted in a requisitioned hotel. Heysham is on Lancashire's Costa del Sol. I've been waiting to get myself fit to write to you all night. I've sat all night in the hot, crowded lounge, armchairs all choked with people, air all heavy and clogged with bad smoke and breath, and loud talk and louder wireless. Now, by sitting it out till 10:30, people are drifting off to bed and it's possible to write. In quoting this extract, I've relied on you to recognize at once the reason for my having chosen it. It exactly corresponds, well, not exactly, because Fuller, I suspect, is an in an other ranks naffy, not in an officer's hotel. It corresponds with those reservations. It corresponds very closely to the scene from which Fuller's Spring 1942 emerges. As I've let things stand at this point, it is grossly unfair to Lewis. I am placing a hasty, unrevised scrawl alongside a poem in which a language metamorphosis has taken place, a weirdly beautiful metamorphosis. Let me attempt to right that wrong. Song on seeing dead bodies floating off the Cape. The first month of his absence, I was numb and sick, and where he'd left his promise, life did not turn or kick. The seed of love, was sick. The second month, my eyes were sunk in the darkness of despair, and my bed was like a grave, and his ghost was lying there, and my heart was sick with care. The third month of his going, I thought I heard him say, our course deflected slightly on the 32nd day. The tempest blew his words away, and he was lost among the waves, his ship rolled helpless in the sea. The fourth month of his voyage, he shouted grievously, beloved, do not think of me. The flying fish, like kingfishers, skim the sea's bewildered crests. The whales blow steaming fountains. The seagulls have no nests where my lover sways and rests. We never thought to buy and sell this life that blooms or withers in the leaf. And I'll not stir so he sleeps well, though cell by cell the coral reef builds an eternity of grief. But oh, the drag and dullness of myself, the turning seasons wither in my head, all this slowness, all this hardness, the nearness that is waiting in my bed, the gradual self-effacement of the dead. The dead bodies floating off the Cape of Good Hope, the southern tip of the African continent, Lewis would certainly have seen and experienced en route to India by troop transport in December 1942. Such convoys could not be routed through the Mediterranean because of the enemy sea and air bases in Sicily and Crete. The route via the Cape was not free from threat, however, and convoys were frequently attacked, mostly by U-boats, sometimes by surface raiders, in the sea area between Cape Town and Freetown in Sierra Leone. The germ, by which I mean that which germinates, of the poem, is perhaps to be found in a letter from Lewis to his wife, written en route, and alluding to the many sinkings off the Cape lately. The Llandaff Castle went down only 50 miles away. In fact, we picked up four poor devils floating helplessly on spars in the mighty current that flows there, far away from any sign of ship or battle, bits of wreckage floating past, and from one of them we spotted, though we couldn't believe it at first, an arm waving feebly. Our escort, that's a destroyer escort, was already running up to them, and sailors hanging from ropes caught them as she went past at snail's pace and pulled them out of the sea. Lewis chooses to cast his poem in an idiom which suggests, without closely replicating particular features, the folk song tradition, with its conventions of the lost lover and of the affirmations of the boy, against the odds, of course, that he will make heroic efforts to return to his girl. Oh, fare you well, my own true love. Oh, fare you well, my own true love. Oh, fare you well for a while, and I will surely return back again. If I go 10,000 a mile, my dear, if I go 10,000 a mile, shall the stars fall from the skies, my dear, or the rocks melt with the sun? I will never be false to the girl of my heart till all these things be done, my dear. Till all these things be done. The invocation at the start of the first two lines is once more the Vatico, because the tragic emotions of the two peasant lovers are as worthy of such exclamatory force as are those of fine gentlemen and ladies. It's that theme of the innate natural virtue of the commonalty, which can be enhanced by nurture, a theme which Shakespeare shades in with his customary craft towards the conclusion of The Winter's Tale. And so we wept, and there was the first gentlemanlike tears that ever we shed. Equally appropriately, the vocation in the first line of the final stanza of Alan Lewis's poem is the demotic O. Perhaps instinctively democratic. His poems, as well as his letters from India, reveal an autodidactic moral and political concern for the lives of the indigenous peoples of the subcontinent. And one can scarcely doubt that had he lived to return to the United Kingdom, he would have been one of many thousands of serving members of the armed forces and ex-servicemen and women who in 1945 voted in that first Labour administration, the administration that was to found the NHS by an overwhelming majority. In fact, I cannot readily imagine someone born in South Wales in 1915 choosing to vote any other way in 45. Both the metrical scheme and the rhyme scheme of the song are beautifully out of kilter, which I take to mean squinted, not quite in regular order. From the way the stanzas sit on the page, I immediately thought, ah, this is tetrameter. But in fact, the meter continuously lilts between trimeter and tetrameter until the two final stanzas, where the alternation is between tetrameter and pentameter, the latter, as you know, being the meter of Shakespearean blank verse, of Paradise Lost and the Prelude, and of the heroic couplet employed by Dryden and Pope. As to the rhyme scheme, lines 2, 4, 5 of each five-line stanza, except for stanza 5, rhyme BCBB. But the first and the third lines, the A and the C lines, as it were, remain unrhymed. Found in both 17th century English art song, in, for example, Henry Purcell, and in 18th, 19th century folk song, is a subgenre we may call the mad maid song, the young woman driven out of her wits by the tragic outcome of sexual desire. Either her love has been drowned at sea or slain in a sea battle, or shot dead while serving in the Low Countries or High Germany under the Duke of Marlborough, or equally commonly, he has abandoned her and gone off with some saucy Nancy. The woman who sings Lewis's song is not mad, though she is grief-stricken. We could let her epithet for the sea itself, the flying fish like kingfishers skim the sea's bewildered crest, drift back, as it were, upon her own condition of mind. She is not mad, she is bewildered. Look up bewildered in the 20-volume OED of 1989. Lost in pathless places, at a loss for one's way, figuratively, confused mentally, in transferred youth, use, pathless, trackless, mazy, utterly confused or tangled. 1820, Keats's Hyperion, Book 3, 9, wandering in vain about bewildered shores. The word hovers so tellingly between active and passive. The sea's crests are pathless, trackless, utterly confused or tangled, as they must seem to anyone helplessly adrift among them, as she imagines her love to be helplessly adrift among them. But she too is both helplessly adrift in her human grief, but at the same time she is vatically possessed, she is sibylline. She is remarkably accurate in her scenic projections. The flying fish like kingfishers could be by Edward Thomas. Lewis greatly admired him. And Raiders' Dawn and Other Poems, 1942, his first book, contains a beautiful elegiac poem entitled To Edward Thomas on Visiting the Memorial Stone Above Steep in Hampshire, which concludes projected books, half thoughts, the children's birthdays, and wedding anniversaries as cold as dates in history, the dream emerging from the fact that folds a dream, the endless rides of stormy branched dark, whose fibers are a thread within the hand, till suddenly at Arra you possessed that hinted land. In one of my previous lectures, I can't here and now tell you which, I suggested that Edward Thomas was less the finest nature poet of the 20th century than he was perhaps that century's best but least recognized metaphysical poet, a metaphysical poet who happens to use a few years' worth of precise nature notes contained in his many commercially drudged prose writings as the intimate ambience for his metaphysical perceptions. I recall that suggestion now in order to state my belief that Lewis also, in such poems as the song immediately under discussion, is essentially a metaphysical, and that he discovered how to write so, at least in part, from Edward Thomas. It would be critically unscrupulous if I were to omit to say, and also at least in part, from Rainer Maria Rilke, page 283 of Lewis's Letters to My Wife, I think clinches that. And the great Austro-German Czech poet was much in the minds of that wartime generation. Sidney Keyes, in particular, is very strongly indebted to Rilke. But Keith Douglas, while in North Africa, had with him two books of Rilke's poems, one in German, one in English. I get the impression that all three were able to read Rilke in the original German. In the years that Europe was being torn apart, they were remarkable Europeans. Though cell by cell the coral reef builds an eternity of grief, the energy of fine poetry is not unrelated to the oxymoron. A coral reef is built, I would guess, by a process of passivity as much as by activity. And that's how poem grows, rather like a coral reef. These lines are in themselves an image of how poems are made. At a time when 20th century poets were still taught to read the great romantics by learning to apply the active intelligence by way of language to the passivity of things. That's good. By learning to apply the active intelligence by way of language to the passivity of things, the feel of not to feel it. The final line in Alan Lewis's song, The Gradual Self-Effacement of the Dead, one of the great culminating lines in 20th century poetry in English, is simultaneously true, therefore, of our common metaphysical and existential awareness and imperviousness, and not true of our common metaphysical and existential awareness, imperviousness. The gradual self-effacement of the dead immediately annuls what it claims to affirm, the line itself simply being so memorable. Oh, 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 that Shakespearean rag, it's so elegant, so intelligent. Lines 128, 130 of The Wasteland, 1922. Lines which thereby antedate not only the Fuller and the Lewis, but also Yeats's The Tower of 1928 and The Winding Stair of 1933. But these lines also predate The Wasteland by 10 years. How can that be? They are to be found, old Casper replies, in an American ragtime tune and lyric of 1912. That Shakespearean rag, words by Gene Buck and Herman Ruby, music by David Stamper. The words Eliot purloins are from the chorus. He changes Shakespearean to Shakespearean, most intelligent, very elegant, to it's so elegant, so intelligent, and omits, though I don't doubt it's in his mind throughout the writing of The Wasteland and even later pieces, that old classical drag has a prof of stuff, the line Leon Macduff. In my school and university days, one tended to think that when Eliot quoted something, it was thereafter in magic amberlade. This is no longer thought, and in any case, if devaticizing the Vatic is as significant as I have been attempting to show, then the credit for the particular wordplay, with which I hope I have at least amused you a little, should be credited to Jean Buck and Herman Ruby. It is never wise to undervalue the ears-to-the-ground prescience of Tin Pan Alley. I have not, in this lecture, been attempting to establish some infallible rule of poetic oratory. I have little doubt that there will be many poems in which the distinction between the oratorical O and the demotic O is determined by whimsy or ignorance. I have been attempting to show merely how two particularly fine poems of the Second World War contrived to have their say. The feel of not to feel it when there is none to heal it, nor numbed sense to steal it, was never sent in rhyme, was never said in rhyme. The statement is contrived. Of course it can be said in rhyme. Keats has just done so. For good and for ill, poems are contrived. C-O-E-D for that word's ambivalences. Keats is especially good, in fact, on the nature of the feel of not to feel it. C-E-G, Hyperion of Fragment, lines 112, 116. Powerful poetry, as I've said, is weird. Bad poetry is sickeningly obvious. But now my voice is beginning to shake and rise in pitch, and my eyes to become fixed and glazed, and it is therefore time to stop.